cases because I was talking before here and I was really worried that we'll be hearing the same thing. So happy to see new faces. And no, Thomas from IFIE. Hi, Thomas. And Arden's heard this before, I know for sure. But I think that's it. So the rest of you are, and I know Marion, the rest of you are BHI students. So I think this is pretty small, so we could probably keep it pretty informal, right? And feel free to ask questions and I'll get started. So I changed the name of the talk. It's really more about customizations that we made to the EHR as opposed to, so what I'm not going to do is give a general talk on just the literature review of the pluses and minuses and the evidence to support using the EHR for quality and safety. What I'm going to do instead is specifically talk about the work we've been doing at, well, the work I started here at the University of Washington as a fellow, so I finished my fellowship in 2009, and specifically about the ongoing work we've done at Virginia Mason, which is where I work downtown, half-time as a hospitalist, so I take care of patients in the internal medicine, patients in the hospital, and the other half of the time working at various IT projects. And my primary job and goal is to figure out how to use our EHR at Cerner, just like the UW, how to use it to improve quality and safety. So, and that work is all really revolved around customizations of the EHR. Out of the box, it only does so much. So at Virginia Mason, this is our strategic plan, and we show this all over the place at every meeting. We have the patient on top, and it's all about the patient. And our goal is to be the quality leader. So one of the foundational elements to achieving that goal is using our IT technology, our electronic medical record, to get there, to be quality leader. So the question becomes, how do we do that, and in what ways are we trying to be the quality leader? And safety is the other big part of that. It's not just quality, it's safety. So I'm going to start sort of the story, because again, this is not a literature review. I'm telling you about my personal experience with why I did the fellowship in the first place and the first project I got started on and the clinical problem that I wanted to solve. And I thought that our medical records, our EMRs, would be a great solution too. So this is the problem of patients who are in the hospital and who either die or have a cardiac arrest or get transferred emergently to the intensive care unit. And especially when they die unexpectedly, we look at their chart and we see, is there anything that we could have done to prevent this or recognize it earlier? And sometimes what we see are these trends. So you're seeing that in this patient, the blood pressure over time had been declining and the heart rate was going up and the respiratory rate was going up. And so the sort of writing was on the wall. And in fact, 2 hours before the patient had died, the vital signs were critically abnormal, but no one noticed them. And this, unfortunately, sadly happens. This is not an isolated case. So for me, the question was, how can we use our, all these vital signs are in the EMR. Can we leverage that in some way to bring this to people's attention so that we can make sure this never, ever happens? So most of these patients are getting sick from sepsis. That's the primary clinical process that we're dealing with. And sepsis is not just a rock band. It's a decompensation. It's a physiologic decompensation, usually the result of infection. So low blood pressure and rapid heart rate and shock, basically. So that's the clinical scenario that we're trying to address. And Marion's been very involved with that at the UW here. And about 200,000 individuals die per year from sepsis in the U.S., and a lot of those are in the hospital. So there's national campaigns to prevent this, to recognize it, and to treat it. So it's not always treatable, but there's great literature that shows that if you get patients IV fluids and antibiotics really quickly and aggressively, that outcomes are significantly improved. So there's really not a big gap in terms of treatment. The big problem is in recognition. So about 3,000 hospitals in the U.S. now have developed something called a rapid response team. And this is a team that's supposed to be called to see patients who have low blood pressure or fast heart rate or fast breathing or low oxygenation. And someone taking care of the patient should hopefully notice that, like when they record the vital signs, for instance, and call this team. And a lot of times the vital signs are being measured, though, by what are called patient care techs, so they're not nurses. And they have training and they're told what to do. But anyway, it doesn't always happen. So someone has to call the team, and therefore the rapid response team, is sort of set up and structured like a fire station model, right? Someone has to dial 911. The fire trucks aren't going to come unless someone calls them. And the problem with that system, unlike most people, fires usually get noticed, and people usually call for fires. But the problem is they don't always call, as I pointed out, for these horribly ill patients. And why don't they call? Because humans make errors, right? Errors human. We learned about, reminded about that by the Institute of Medicine in 1999. So people make mistakes, and they don't notice these things. And so why are they not being noticed? And raise your hand if you've seen this video. Keep it really high. Raise your hand high if you've seen this. So one, two, three, four. Okay, so most of you have. Okay, so we'll do it. So this is going, we're going to do this little exercise here that's going to help you appreciate why these patients get missed. Now, if you've seen this video, please don't say a single word. Thank you. So what those of you who haven't seen it are going to do is you notice there's two teams of players. You want to turn off the lights? Let's turn off the light for a second to make this a little easier to see. So there's two teams of players, and one team is wearing white. One team, that's fine. This is a short video. It won't take a minute. One team's wearing white shirts. The other team's wearing black shirts. And they're going to be passing the basketball. So what I want you to do is count the number of times the team wearing the white shirts passes the ball. Okay? Team wearing the white, count the number of times the team wearing white passes the ball. Okay, you turn on the light. Yeah. So for those of you who hadn't seen this, you turn on the light. You turn it on. Thank you. So for those of you who haven't seen this before and counted, how many times did the team wearing white pass the ball?
18.
I think it's about 18. 18, good. So again, this is only for those of you who haven't seen it. Did you see anything else odd going on?
Black gorilla.
You saw the gorilla. Anybody else see the gorilla?
Yes.
Good, good. So this I'm going to show it to you one more time. Did anybody not see the gorilla? You could. Did you see the gorilla? I'll show it to you again. So this is the same exact video, no tricks whatsoever. If you don't believe me, you can come look at it on the computer afterwards. No tricks. So, the moral of the story is what?
Get distracted. Tunnel vision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, yeah, so we have tunnel vision. We're working on one thing, and we're not noticing other major things that could be going on. And in particular, if you're not looking for something specifically, if you weren't, the way this works is that if you're not really looking for a gorilla, you probably aren't going to see it. You're focused on other things. So that's why these patients get missed, these patients whose vital signs are deteriorating because the people taking care of them are not their primary focus, and they're busy doing, they're giving the medications, and they're doing a lot of other care, so they get missed. So what we wanted to do is use the EMR to change this fire station model and not rely on people noticing these sick patients and then calling someone else, but instead make it more of like an air traffic control surveillance model where the team who's responsible for getting to those patients and rescuing them has a surveillance system whereby they can monitor all the patients in the hospital, and they can detect when there's a patient who meets that criteria for them being called. So it's sort of like the fire tower, the guy standing up in the fire tower. Probably would be a better analogy. So that's great. So we said, let's build this tool within our electronic medical record that allows this rapid response team, a surveillance tool, to screen all the patients in the hospital and find out who's ill. So when you're a clinician like me and you go to the IT guys and say, hey, can you guys do that? It's sort of like, it feels like scaling Mount Everest, because for most of history of EMRs, the answer was no, we can't do that. We can't do any customizations. It's really, you know, we get this thing as it is. It wasn't designed to do that. If you want us to do it, maybe after, you know, trying to hack it for 2 years, we'll come up with something that'll be really awful. So clinicians are really discouraged. Because part of it is the tools that the programmers have. They have to use this proprietary language that very few people know. Like for Cerner, it's a Cerner command language. And, you know, at our institution, we have like two people that know it. So it's not like you could put out a job ad for hire someone with Cerner, who knows Cerner command language, because it's very few people who know it. So finally, the company saw the writing on the wall that they better fix this and allow the people who work on the front lines who know what the system really needs to do, give them some tools to build these things into the system, like the tools that I'm describing. So they created this thing called MPages. And M stands for Millennium, which is the proprietary name for the Oracle database that the whole thing sits on, and Pages as in web pages. So basically, you could go query the data in their database. This is the vital sign data. And you still need to write some of this CCL script, so some of their command language, to create a custom table. But once you have a custom table, from there it gets really easy, because then you could create a web page. So now you're talking about HTML and JavaScript skills, which are very easy to find, and we have lots of people who know that. So create a web page to present the data. So all of a sudden they release this tool, and lo and behold, all these Cerner sites are able to start doing really fantastic, creative, cool things with their EMR that serve the clinical needs. So this is a screen that we created. Dave Stone, working with Matt Schaff here at UW-IT, created this M page. So it's a web page, again, that's sitting right inside the EMR, accessing some custom tables, and using JavaScript, so it has drop-downs. And basically what this thing does is it's a tool now for anybody in the hospital could look at it, and it gives you the opportunity to see who in the hospital has critically abnormal vital signs. So the first column here on this page, and let me just backtrack for 1 second to say the EMR is primarily a tool designed to look at a single patient's chart. So this ability to look at a group of patients all at the same time is not out of the box. It's pretty unique for an EMR. It seems pretty primitive, right? I mean, it doesn't seem particularly sophisticated, but to get an EMR to do this is actually tricky. So they did that, and the first column on this spreadsheet, on this grid here, this called the early warning system, shows the number of vital signs that a patient has that's critically abnormal. So if you have this first patient here, and it's sorted by that column. So this first patient on this is all of UW Hospital. And the patient names, so the big blue, this is just the patient names blotted out. It's not usually that ugly. And so this first column is called the RT for Rapid Response Team. And you can see there's a 2, and it's color-coded because that patient has 2 critically abnormal vital signs, 2 out of 4, because remember, we're just looking at 4 different vital signs. And if you hover the mouse over it, they have a hover box that pops up, and it says that the systolic blood pressure is 85, which is dramatically low, and heart rate was 150, dramatically high. So that's why that patient got 2 points, and they're the sickest one right now in the hospital. And we filtered out ICU patients, and we filtered out emergency room patients. So you're only looking at the population that you really are interested in for the team. So now that they see, that's interesting, this patient clearly meets the criteria for a call to the rapid response team. I wonder why no one's called us. We better go check it out. And they go and check it out, and lo and behold, the patient is very sick. It does need to go to the intensive care unit and does need therapy. So they are able to, there's an intervention for that patient that probably made a big difference. This is, the second column is an attempt to be a little more sophisticated about how we rank the patients. So that's MUSE for Modified Early Warning System score. It's a numeric quantitative score. So whereas the first column is just counting the number of critically abnormal vital signs, the second column is a linear scale. So it's like the lower the blood pressure, the higher the number. And then it brings in some other data too, some other lab data that's abnormal in patients with sepsis, so like the white blood cell count and other some chemistries, so that it was meant to be a more sensitive screening process for patients with sepsis. So they could sort by that column too. And one of the things that was good about this is that with this drop-down, the rapid response team watches the whole entire hospital, but if you work on just a specific unit, like you're the manager of a unit, then you would select your unit, and this way you can just monitor the patients on your floor. Or if you're a physician who has, you have a discrete team of patients, like 12 patients, but they're scattered all over the hospital, then you could just watch your team. So that's Yeah, those. Talked about the pop-up. And then to, one thing we also wanted, the nurses, these rapid response team nurses are pretty busy, so we wanted to give them a really quick and easy way to tell whether or not a patient who's showing up here is actually deteriorating and getting sicker, or maybe they're always like this, or maybe they're actually getting better. So they click on the score, and this pop-up opens up, and they can see the trends in the blood pressure, and the heart rate, and the respiratory rate, and the O2 sat, so they can see which way things are trending, and that gives them a better idea of whether or not they actually need to go intervene or not worry about it. So it's a very quick review, and again, they were never able to do this before. They just had to wait and hope that someone would give them a call. Sometimes there's patients who are really ill, but their comfort cure, nothing is going to be done, with no aggressive intervention that will be instituted. So they check that comfort cure box, and the patient disappears from the dashboard. Or sometimes they're a patient who's been like that for a while, and what they want to do is snooze it for a while. So they could use this drop down to like snooze it for 8 hours or 12 hours, and then it'll disappear for a short period of time, but then they'll pop up again. And then they have a column where they could leave notes to each other, because there's multiple nurses doing this, so they had a field there to leave notes for each other. So we did a randomized clinical trial with this thing, with this tool during the final months of my fellowship, and it was a unique design that took me about a year to convince the IRB to do, because patients weren't being consented. But what it was called an interrupted time series. So it was on for both all of Harborview and UW. It was on for both hospitals for all areas for a week. And then Monday morning at 8 o'clock, we'd switch it off, and it would stay off for a week. And then the next Monday morning at 8 o'clock, we'd switch it back on. We did that on-off thing for 20 weeks total. So we had 10 weeks where it was on and 10 weeks where it was off. And that really freaked the IRB out. And we did that, so 20 weeks total. And then we compared the outcomes. So that was our method of randomization. Since we couldn't randomize patients, we and didn't want to randomize units because they're too different. The patient populations are too different. When we try to say these three floors will get it and those three floors won't. And it's the rapid response team anyway that's looking at the information. So that was going to be too difficult. So that's why we chose that method. And it was pretty good randomization method, controlling for other variables. And the outcomes we looked at were whether or not we had any impact on the potentially on the avoidable deaths and on the cardiac arrest rate and the transfers to the intensive care unit, and then just the rate of activating the rapid response team. So what we found, and still trying to publish, is that there was no difference in the amount of cardiac arrest for when it was on versus when it was off, and there was a significant increase in the number of times the rapid response team was activated, and that wasn't a surprise because now they had a tool to spot the patients. And but the UW, there was many fewer at the UW than at Harborview, interestingly. There was no difference in the frequency of death, and there were more patients that were transferred to the ICU during the intervention, and that was sort of an interesting, we're happy about the result, it was a good result, but it was sort of goes counter to the whole rapid response team thing, because in all the rapid response team literature, they look to see if the rapid response team decreases the rate of transfer to the ICU. So this tool actually increased the rate of transfer to the ICU, which we see as good, because what it told us is that there are patients out there that really should have been in the ICU that weren't getting transferred, and our tool gave the clinicians a better opportunity to recognize those patients and get them where they need to be. So the next step, one of the limiting factors, the greatest limitation of doing this thing, was that the nurses, the rapid response team nurses who are responsible for looking at that thing, they're really busy and they're constantly running around the hospital trying to put out 14 different fires at the same time. And how often can we get them to stop and log into the computer and look at that early warning system? And they said, if you can only put it in my pocket, it sure would be a lot better. So we're still, the technology, again, when you try to do something with EMRs, Amazon can do that in a day or whatever, and restaurants do it. And we all have 50,000 apps on our iPhones to do amazing things, but you try to do something with clinical information, it's just so, takes so long. So we're getting closer to this, and we have we're piloting some web apps, basically, not native apps, and I think we're going to be able to get there, but still 2 years we've been working on. So that's basically the aspect of this around safety. What I'm going to switch to now is more of the quality piece. But let me just take a quick break to see if anybody has any questions about that part.
Does it take long because of the paperwork, or does it take long just because information is so hard to put out to?
Exactly. Yes, yes, and yes. It takes long because, well, there's a budget, right, and it's all, there's all these different projects that the IT team is devoting attention to, and they're all, you know, high priority. So this one tends to not get, it's not like a, okay, so for instance, the UW right now is putting up CPOE, right, so clinician provider order entry, computerized order entry. And that's a massive, very expensive project, and that, like, consumes all the resources. So when you say to them, well, can you put up a web server, you know, it's called WebSphere, to do this other thing, they're like, that sounds great, get online behind the 50 other people who have great ideas. So that's, so it's competing with projects, it's competing with money, and then you get all the, you know, the wireless aspects of it. When you're talking to wireless PC in the hospital, it has different, and I'm not a technical person, but it has different layers of protection as opposed to when you're talking to an iPhone in terms of the, whether, you know, the confidentiality, it all has to be secure communication. So there's technical aspects of it that get more difficult. So, and you know, you're going out on your own because the vendor's not really supporting it. And so those are a lot of the reasons it takes amazing amounts of time. It's a good question. Any other questions about that?
Is this some kind of a way to push important alerts out to the nurses, like with automated page, for instance, or does it entirely rely on nurses checking this on a regular basis?
Well, that's a good question. Yeah, the system does have the ability to generate alerts out to nurses. Maybe Marion can talk more about what the UW is doing in that regard, but we didn't do it for this because there's so much of it is noise, and so the signal-to-noise ratio is such that the nurse would throw the page in the toilet bowl after about the first 8 hours, I guess, because there's so many patients with abnormal vital signs that don't need their attention. So Marion's been involved with work at the UW where they're trying to increase the specificity of that. So you want to say something about
that? Yeah, I know they are at the Harborview pilot for their sepsis, automated sepsis screening. They're starting to page people, the attendings.
I think that the nurse has to, it requires a manual intervention on the part of the nurse. So the nurse sees the score is high, and the nurse basically says, is this real or not? And if the nurse says it's real, then it goes out on the page. So the nurse is a filter, to filter the noise out. But there's not a great way yet. That's where hopefully you guys could come to the rescue. I mean, I think, you know, once we have apply more machine learning algorithms to this and look at massive historical groups of data and figure out highly reliable ways to sort out the patients who are really deteriorating, because we're not looking at trends. So for instance, if you start looking at trends and are able to detect the trends, then your signal-to-noise ratio will improve dramatically. But we don't have the, I think we have the software capabilities to do that. We just haven't had the anybody jumping on that yet. So if anybody's interested in working on something like that, we'd be very excited to have you engaged.
And one last minute, sorry. So you have to have the nurses log in, and it causes them time constraints. Because, have you ever thought of just having a monitor that constantly shows it, or is there?
Yes, perfect segue to what's coming next. Thank you. So I am going to answer that, just not the same.
I'm just curious how you sold this to your IT department and their support.
Yeah, that's a great question. Because, you know, like I said, there's 50 people that are knocking on their door, and everybody has their great idea. And how do you get your idea to be the one that they do? Because, you know, they have very little, really aggressive time schedules for implementing new functionality. And, it's tricky. And you got to, you know, get the right people excited. And it has to really mesh with what I found with IT. Health IT projects is, like, there's 1,000 great ideas, but the only ones that you'll get to gain traction are the ones that are consistent with your organizational goals. So the whole sepsis thing, the whole national sepsis campaign and preventing avoidable deaths through sepsis was a real large, it was a national initiative. It was a UW initiative, right, in 2008 or so when I started knocking on their door.
So essentially had a prototype to demonstrate it. Mason.
Oh, how did it get VM to do it?
I mean, no, I'm just saying you took convince VM. Yeah, I'm sure you showed them your prototype in a sense.
Yeah, the VM was the easier sell. It was you did it by IT. Yeah. That was the harder sell.
Yeah.
But it was perfect, sort of like a perfect storm, because the other thing that was happening was they just got this mPages thing from Cerner, and they were an alpha test site for mPages. They were like, what sort of cool things can we do with this? And like that next week, I knocked on the door and said, do you guys have any tools that you could create this? Or actually, I asked them to do it in a much more primitive way than we had tried it at VM, using a lot of Cerner reverse engineering hacking. And I said, so I went to IT here and said, can you guys do that? And they said, well, actually, just last week, we got this really new cool tool called mPages that we think can do this pretty easily that we'd love to try out. So the organization has to be interested. The IT department has to be interested. And if you can get that alignment and get that, you know, this ball rolling, then you can get it to snowball and avalanche and get it actually off the ground. But that's, yeah, it's a great question, because it's difficult.
Right.
Yeah, especially because I didn't have a grant to do this with either, right? So this is. So now we're going to talk a little bit about how to use the system to ensure quality. And again, I'm not doing a literature search on like whether or not a computer order entry improves quality or anything like that. I'm just going to tell you about the projects we did for quality. But I wanted to talk a little bit about what is quality in the hospital in the first place. How do you define quality? And I don't know, fortunately or unfortunately, it's defined for us. So the Health and Human Services defines what is hospital quality. And they do that. So hospitals are required to report this quality data to them. And they make that all publicly available on the web. Anybody can go to hospitalcompare.gov. hhs.hospitalcompare.gov, yes, and see this publicly reported data about quality. And you can see that they break quality down into four different categories. So the process of care, and I'll talk more about this, but that means did you give the patient the right medication, basically, for what they have. The outcomes of care, did they live or did they die, did they have a heart attack, these are the clinical outcomes. Medical imaging, I'm not going to get into, and then hospital, their patients' perception of their hospital experience, I'm not going to get into. So these things, this one is new, but using your IT systems to impact outcomes is really difficult. You need big numbers, and so I felt like the money is in, that the computer's particularly good when it comes to process of care, basically reminding clinicians to do what they're supposed to do to meet these requirements. So we focus on process of care for quality. And in particular, then what they do is split it out into heart attacks versus heart failure. So heart failure, so heart attack is, for those of you who are not, most of you are probably not clinical, right? So heart attack, you have some death of the heart muscle. It's an acute event. And heart failure, however, is a chronic disease process where the heart doesn't pump adequately, usually as a result of prior heart attacks. And then pneumonia. And surgical care. So pneumonia, heart failure, surgical care, and MI. And so these are the outcomes that they look at, like death rates and readmission rates. And these are all clinical outcomes. Like I said, it's very difficult to have a major impact on these things. So that's not where we put our efforts. Where we put our efforts instead are on the processes of care. So these are some examples. If you can pull these graphs up off of hospitalcompare.gov. You can also go to whynotthebest.org. That's another place where this data is presented. It's a different organization that presents the same data, a little more slick presentation. But you can pull up an area code or Seattle. So I pulled up these three hospitals in Seattle. This was, I think, as of March 2011. And they show you all the U.S., Washington State. And this is a process measurement. So you have a patient in a hospital with pneumonia. Did you ask them if they've had their pneumovax, and did you give it to them if they need it? And what do you think about these rates? Good, bad, horrible, great, fantastic. What's that?
Very good.
So you're calling it very good. Anybody else? So these are high 90s, and I think that you're right, we used to call this very good. and but at Virginia Mason, we don't call that very good. So, and I'll show you why in a minute. So here's six different quality measurements at Virginia Mason. And again, you might look at these and you might say, oh, that's pretty darn good, right? Unless you're the patient who didn't get it, in which case, not good at all. So these are all, again, these are process metrics. So did you give the medication to the patient with heart failure? Did you give that Pneumovax vaccine? Did you get blood cultures in your pneumonia patients? Did you give the influenza vaccine to your pneumonia patients? Did you give instructions to your patients with heart failure before you sent them out the door? And did you another medication for patients with heart failure? So did you do those things? And we have a whole team, a whole army of, these numbers are not generated automatically. This is all generated through manual chart abstraction. Well, they're not flipping pages anymore, but they're clicking through the EMR to see if these things were done. It's very labor intensive and expensive, but it's required these numbers are reported out. So we have this thing of Virginia, so Virginia Mason has gone on this journey over the last 6 years with lean and quality and using the depth in the Toyota production system. And there's a Virginia Mason Institute now which focuses on that. And so these slides are from them. But here's 96% quality multiplied. So 0.04 times the number of things we do. So we give 0.04 times the number of surgeries we do per year, we would have 600 defective surgeries per year, which is awful, right? That's horrible. Or 0.04 times the number of medications we administer per year, that would be 40,000 defective medication administrations. So we definitely don't see 96% as good. So how about 99.9? So should that be our goal? And the answer is absolutely not. That is definitely not good enough, because when that's your goal, if you'll still have 15 defective surgeries per year. And if that's you or your family member, you're not going to think of that as a very good performance. So our goal is zero, is to have no defects, is to be defect-free. Our goal for that reporting out on those parameters is to be at 100% for everything, because that's the only right thing to do. You want everybody to take care of to get what they need. And so again, that comes back to, so how do we use our electronic medical record to do that? So that's basically my job, is to figure out how we use our EMR to achieve that goal. One of the things when it comes, this is sort of a little tangent though, but one of the things that clinicians sometimes complain about, that they need convincing about, and maybe some of you are thinking it too, is those are just numbers, you know, in the hospital. We're just playing these numbers game to look good on paper, and I don't have time to help you make your numbers look good because I'm taking care of patients, so leave me alone. So sometimes we have to remind the clinicians that, no, this is all evidence-based, and in fact, that when your care is compliant with those parameters, your patients do better. So here's a study, one study we show them. This is 1,700 patients. It was an international cohort, 43 different centers, 12 countries, and when patients get care that is compliant, that slide didn't load right for some reason. Let's try that one more time. So patients get the care they're supposed to get according to these guidelines that were being measured by. Mortality goes down, length of stay goes down, clinical stability occurs faster. So it really does make a difference to stick with those guidelines, and that's just a message we have to remind people about occasionally. Another way to remind them that is there's an organization called HealthGrades that does a lot of interesting things with the data, and they rate hospitals based on the data of 1 to 5 stars, and what they've calculated is that if all the hospitals performed at a 5-star rating level, so they don't all, right, there's a distribution, but if you push everybody up to that 5-star rating level, we probably have saved 21,000 lives in that data collection year and $1.8 billion. So it really makes a difference to stick with those guidelines. So how do we go from that, you know, 97% to 100%? Or how do you go from 99% to 100% using IT? The Institute of Medicine back in 2001 said health IT is the way to go. That's the answer. They said what you got to do is, well, use health IT, and you got to get rid of all the handwritten clinical data, because that's getting in your way. You're never going to get to 100% if you use handwritten data. So the question then becomes, is there really any evidence that using health IT helps hospitals achieve that goal. And there's a lot of mixed literature out there, and it's been, you know, goes around the BHI listserv also, and the AMIA, and there's all sorts of discussions of that. This is one that I pulled out that looked at 167,000 patients, and they found that when patients were cared for at hospitals, that slide didn't load right either, but patients were cared for at hospitals that used various aspects of the electronic medical record, outcomes were better. So using notes, online notes, there were decreased deaths during hospitalizations. Using order entry, there was a dramatically lower death rate after coronary artery bypass grafting. Using clinical decision support, which is like reminders to clinicians, much fewer complications. So there is evidence out there that using the technology makes a difference in clinical outcomes. So, but then you're left with that, your organization, how do you actually implement it, and what piece of it? Because it's not just taking the using Cerner or any EMR out of the box and using it the way it was designed to use it is definitely not going to help you achieve those goals. It's not going to get you to that 100%. So you definitely have to customize, you got to innovate, you got to be creative with it. And what are you going to do? So you need the computer system. I'm going to go a little faster. You need the computer system. You need to have discrete data within your computer system. So I'm going to touch on that. The right software and programming, as opposed to what they give you, the customization tools. And then you need to be able to use your system to give providers feedback in real time. And then you need to be able to create situational awareness. So I'm going to try to go through each of these one at a time. I just want to show you, this is what we're trying to replace with the EMR. This is the Virginia Mason records area. This is after we've been online we went online in 2003 or so. This is about 11 years into it, it's still a massive warehouse. And the UW one is much more daunting. This is an airplane hangar at Sandpoint Way. And it's hard to see with lights, but that thing just goes for miles. I mean, it's incredible. So if that's the way your information is stored, you're not going to get to 100%. Because you need, for instance, a lot of times you need the patient's prior results, the prior data. So if you have to wait 8 hours for it to come from the warehouse, forget about it. So I said you need the computer, and this is what the computer systems look like for the EMRs. This is just for your curiosity. So this is a server cabinet here where we have, in this room is about $40 million worth of equipment. And that's a hard drive stack with 30 terabytes. And when I tell clinicians about this, I have to put it in terms of number of songs. So that would be 7,500,000 songs or 6 years of listening. And those are our tape backups. And it's really expensive. So roughly it costs about $18,000 per bed per year. So just for a single bed in the hospital is really expensive to implement this stuff. So there's the computer system. You also, in order to use your computer system to achieve 100% quality, the data has to be discrete. So obviously this is not discrete data. This will get you absolutely nowhere. And we've had that forever. This is really just free text in a note. And unless you have natural language processing, the computer can't recognize that this patient has pulmonary edema, right? So that's just free text. You need a human to read it to know that. So that's not going to help very much. UW has implemented some natural language processing, but it's mostly for charge capture and billing, but not for clinical care. What's that?
Not for the importance.
This is medication administration record. This is discrete data. And these are orders. This is how an order screen looks, and that generates discrete data. And here's lab information that comes in. That's all discrete data. And then these are power forms. These are basically check-the-box kind of forms that use a lot of, and that creates discrete data. This is a note generator that allows the user to click on different boxes and say that the patient has this and doesn't have that, and power notes. And this does create discrete data. And the most important discrete data that you got to get into your EMR is the disease that the patient has, because if the computer doesn't know that the patient has heart failure, it can't tap you on the shoulder and remind you that you're supposed to use a certain medication for it, which is what your quality things are all revolved around. So getting these diagnoses in as discrete data is, believe it or not, a huge challenge, because clinicians, the tools that the EMR vendors designed to allow clinicians to get these, populate these lists, these diagnosis lists, are really very difficult to work with, and almost very, very few institutions do this. So that's the, so you got the computer system, you have the data, you need the right programming. How many of you ever see this show on TV? My son watches this, so we call it, this is the Pimp My EMR. So the Pimp My Ride, it's Pimp My Ride, they take these cars, these old junker cars, and they turn them into these incredible lists. They paint them and put all these big speakers in. So anyway, this is what I teased Dave Stone about, that I'm using M-Pages, he pimps the EMR. So I told you about M-Pages a little bit earlier when I talked about the safety, but that's another key thing you need, is you need to be able to create the customizations. Also key, and this is one of the most important things, is you need to be able to give clinicians feedback in real time about the mistakes they're making. So typically, the way we've done this over the years is that if Marion's taking care of these patients, he's a doctor, I would give him a report like 3 months later and say, Marion, when you were taking care of those heart failure patients, 96% of them got drugs for heart failure. That's great, but we need you to do a little bit better. Would you try harder next time? And you'll say, okay, I'll try harder next time. And next time he'll get to 97%. And that's not going to get us to 100%, right? So that's our traditional feedback methods. And what we need to do, none of those are in real time. What we need to do is get it in real time, right? We have to tell you right now you have a heart failure patient who right now, at this particular moment, is not getting the medication. Can you add it right now so we can get 100%? So we took this dashboard that looks familiar to you from that rapid response team early warning system thing and just changed the clinical parameters it looks at. So instead of looking at the vital signs, now it's looking at 7 different clinical parameters that are important for quality of care. And if the patient's not getting what they're supposed to get, so the rows are patients, the names are blacked out, and if the patient's not getting what they're supposed to get, then it's red. And if they are getting what they're supposed to get, it's green. So this thing refreshes every 5 minutes. And it gives the providers information in real time about whether or not their patients are getting what they need. And it's interactive, so you could, I'm just going to fly through some of this. These are the different quality parameters. Again, you could set it for a floor, you could set it for an individual team. You could click on an icon that shows you the algorithm behind the yellow, red, green, so you could understand what determines, what do I need to do in order to turn it green. So you don't have to guess. You can't give that patient what they need. This one is asking you to give them a medication called heparin so they don't get blood clots. Well, let's say they are refusing to take it or they're bleeding. I can't give it to them. It's not clinically appropriate. So you click on that little blue icon and this form pops up and you could say why you're not giving it. But this way you could turn that box from red to yellow so you never have to get used to looking at red. Reds are always something you should and must do something about. And again, so that's how we get to the 100%. But that's still not good enough because that's the real-time feedback. That's still not good enough because we know lots of literature on this, including a paper that Tom Payne, some of the faculty here, wrote from data at the VA, that if you give alerts to physicians sort of privately where I'm working on this computer and I get the alert but no one else on this team sees it, I'll ignore it about 70%, well, not me, but clinicians will ignore it about 70% of the time. So just because I'm giving you real-time information doesn't mean you're going to act on it or look at it or do anything about it. So what we said, well, let's look elsewhere to see how this problem has been solved elsewhere. And so there's emerging literature, medical literature, about situational awareness. And they talk about how the Coast Guard does situational awareness and how that enhances safety. And what they do is put information that where they want the team, not just the person, but the whole team to get it right, it's got to be public, and the whole team has to be aware of it. So we have in the operating rooms these dashboards that show which room the patient's in. It doesn't give any clinical information. So we do that, and we have this. This is a bed board. This shows, it's like a big dashboard for what room is empty in the hospital. And here's one, believe it or not, this is all just the dispatch control. They have these beautiful big dashboards about moving patients around the hospital and who needs to be transported where. And even in the cafe at Harborview, they have a dashboard up on the wall so they can change the prices whenever they need to. But in the clinical units, we have this. So, well, you can't really see it, it's too bright, but it's a whiteboard, right? This is not a dashboard. This is a very primitive. This is what we have. Where we really need it, we don't have it. So this gets to your question of a few minutes ago of how about, I think you said putting this up on the boards, on dashboards, on the wall. So we took that same dashboard, and what we did is put it up on a big monitor, and we piloted this at Harborview again and the UW. This is one of the ICUs in the U, and here it is in the ICU at Harborview. And then we started a clinical trial. So we have control units and intervention units. So we had certain units in the hospital that had it and other units that didn't. Then we had an intervention period and a control period. And hopefully what we'll show is that during the intervention period in the intervention units, that will get 100% or at least darn close to it. And this is one in a med-surg setting. I'm going to skip this because we're out of time. And so those are the things I think you need in order to achieve 100% quality. And with that, there's, I guess, a minute for questions. But I'll stick around if anybody has any questions. Thank you. Questions? Yes.
With all of this advantageous work that you've been doing, are there any plans to feed that back to Cerner's or can be monetized or plans to share with other hospitals?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's a huge problem because it's like really inefficient to have everybody reinventing the wheel. I mean, everybody wants this, so why does everybody have to invent it themselves? So Cerner actually scratched their head for a while, and I guess one of them was, while they were scratching their head, they were playing with their iPhone or something. They went to the App Store and downloaded an app, and then they said, oh, why don't we set up an App Store too? This seems to work pretty well. So Cerner is in the process of setting up an app store, and they'll take 30% of the profit. So the UW might, for instance, upload to the app store something that they've done, and then Cerner will sell it. So you have a big selection. It sounds great on paper, and it works for Apple for sure. But when it comes to the medical software, it gets really tricky because there's all these liability issues. So if you do the state of Washington, in order to sell software, you have to accept some liability, but the state of Washington can't accept liability. So some of the stuff that's being done is like it's being spun off to, we're actually involved with spinning this off into a private venture, and then the private venture gets sold.
Does Cerner have a structure for the users, the acquirers of the Cerner system, and part of a user group that has a conceptual content advisory board? You know,
they have physician advisory groups, and they bring them to Kansas City every year, and then they nod their heads and say, "Sure, we'll work on it." But it's not effective.
How does that work in terms of defining a new capability for the Cerner system and developing a work team to do that and then report back and have some positive dialogue? That's been the...
It hasn't. I would say that model has not led to a tremendous amount of innovation. All the innovation, all the great innovation has been done at the client sites with MPHs.
At the client sites.
That's where all the great innovation
is. So do the clients of Cerner system, when they set up their... institutional organization develop an adequate body that draws on the practitioners for the conceptual content and the IT staff for potential...
Usually not, which is why it's so far behind every other industry.
Okay. So they don't have that?
Usually not. Some do, for sure, but not. I would say it's not uniform.
Okay. Seems like there's another class.
Okay, sure.
So let's have a different...
Sure. You bet.